Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jim Quadra. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter. With me is my partner, Rebecca Call. Your Honors, on December 12, 2013, Kaylee Lambert, who has just turned 13 years old, took her own life. In the note she left her parents, she stated as follows: I only ask that you tell my school I killed myself, so maybe the next time people like CH wants to call someone pimple face or emo ass bitch, he won't. Haley's note is the most compelling evidence that the Clark County School District failed Haley and took actions leading to her bullying that led to her tragic death. It's also that note the first time her parents discovered she had been bullied at school because the school district failed to inform them in violation of state law. It was the first time they heard that their daughter had endured months of torment at school where she was called a fat ass, a bitch, and statements like, I hope you died.
Mr. Quadra, this is a very tragic case, and my heart goes out to the family. But how can you distinguish this case from the Supreme Court's decision in DeShaney versus the Winnebago County Department of Social Services, which involved the facts that were just as horrific?
Your Honor, I'm happy to answer the question. The one thing that I do want to point out that we believe that, in fact, the complaint was also violated. Also, Your Honor, I forgot an MA. I want to reserve 3 minutes. So, yes, I believe that DeShaney is a completely different situation because in our situation, when you look at the state-created doctrine, data doctrine, you don't have the situation you have here, and it may be novel. We were unable to find a case on point where you have a state statute that compels conduct by the school district.
Weren't there state statutes for the protection of children in Wisconsin or whatever state that was, that duties to the Department of Social Services to assist or deal with abused children?
I believe, Your Honor, that there were general statements as to how they should conduct their business, but there was no finding in that case that an actual law had been violated. Nor was there an allegation, I believe, on point like this where
there was a failure to protect. It's the same legal theory here as was present in DeShaney.
I believe, Your Honor, to try and
figure out how to legitimately distinguish your case from DeShaney.
Right. Well, there are others, Your Honor, but I just want to point out that I think the case, the court is facing a novel issue, which is when you have a specific statute, as you do in Nevada, that says you shall report this to the parents for the protection of the children, and the school makes a decision to ignore that, that is an action under the state-created danger.
But it's a failure to act, and what you're asking us to do is to equate the failure to act with an intentional action.
Well, Your Honor,
and that was the same theory that was argued to the Supreme Court in DeShaney, and the court said there was no constitutional violation.
Again, on DeShaney, I think the decision was based on not a ministerial act, as here, where it's just a reporting requirement, as opposed to a decision-making as to whether the conditions warrant a change.
In DeShaney, the social workers had actually gone to the home on multiple occasions. They actually removed the young child based on abuse reported by the hospital, and then affirmatively returned the child to the same parent who then did horrible things.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, as I say, I think that case involves even worse facts than the system here, and yet the Supreme Court said that it's not a cause of action against the state.
Again, the Supreme Court looked at the issue of whether that was an affirmative act. Our position, and again, I'll move on to the rest of why DeShaney doesn't fit in, is that ignoring a state-mandated rule that requires a ministerial act, not some decision-making on their part, it must be done, is a failure that actually constitutes an action under the state-created danger doctrine. However,
there would be one else besides that.
Right, that's not situation. So in this case, the facts are different. There is actual actions that are taken. There was a bullying report. Under the law in Nevada, they are supposed to investigate that bullying report. They failed to do that adequately.
That's again a
failure. That's an act.
Well, that's a failure to act. They didn't do something.
No, so they did it. They did it poorly. They actually conducted the investigation.
A failure to do whatever it is you say they were obligated to do. I'm talking about acts that you say made Haley more vulnerable.
What they then did was impose minimal discipline on the bully. And they took an action to impose minimal discipline. And basically telling Haley that the complaints about her bullying and being harassed every day were basically insignificant to the school despite its policies, and specifically showed that by the action of imposing minimal discipline and sending Haley back into the school without any indication that the school would protect her, even though they had promised to do so.
Counsel, I think Senator Judge Watford just articulated the affirmative action prong of the state-created danger exception imposes a test as to whether or not whatever it was that the official did it place Haley in a worse situation than she would have been in had school officials done nothing. How is that test met on this record?
Well, again, if you have a child that is promised that they will be protected at school by the school district's own policies that are enumerated to the kids, and then that policy is taken lightly by the school, and minimal action is taken to protect her, the effect is to create a despondency in that child, who then writes a note on the day she takes her own life and says the school should learn from this, because with me they did nothing.
So is your theory that what the state did here was somehow a proximate cause of her despondency that resulted in suicide?
Well,
is that it?
Is that the school and its conduct led to her suicide? And in fact, the school has a policy that says that bullying is a nexus to suicide.
Is there any evidence in the record that any school official knew that Haley was exhibiting suicidal ideation?
There was a testimony by school officials that they believed, at least one of them, they believed that if the parents had been informed of the bullying, that Haley would be alive.
That's not my question.
But as to your question.
You didn't answer my question. Did you understand the question?
I understand the question about suicidal. Right. So I do not know. I think that the record reflects that they were aware of suicidal ideation. But I am aware that the policies that protect against bullying indicate that suicide is likely our potential cause. In fact, that's a policy of the school that wasn't given to us in this case and provided in the state underlying case.
Is the failure on the part of the school official to act essentially maintain the status quo, which was she was still susceptible to bullying? How did the state create an enhanced danger beyond what she was already exposed to?
Well, again, if you intervene, which they did, and do it poorly, and then take actions that signal to the child that the school administration is not any way that she's going to be protected, and she is placed back in the environment where the bullying will continue untethered.
Isn't that what happened in DeShaney? I mean, the social workers reached her and the child, after she had been assaulted on multiple occasions, to the custody of the abuser who then continued the pattern of abuse.
That child was 4 years old. Haley was 13. You're left to know what the school did affect her.
Would it have made a difference in DeShaney if the child was 8 years old or 10 years old? Do you think that the...
I think that if the child had been older and written a note that said that the state had failed them because they took actions that were improper, we would have a way of looking at what the net effect of that conduct is. But with a 4-year-old, which is maybe not even aware of what, obviously not aware of what the duties of the state are, it's completely different than with a 13-year-old who's fully aware of the policy of the school, and that the school takes minimal action to protect her.
Does the policy of the law mean even higher to protect a more vulnerable younger victim than an older
Well, Your Honor, I don't disagree that DeShaney is wrong, but that's my point. I understand, but DeShaney deals with the specific facts that involve a 4-year-old. If you look at this case,
distinguishing DeShaney on the age of the victim,
on their mental capacity to understand the conduct, is minimal action by the state that then creates.
In what case would you rely
cases that he cited for the purpose of state-created danger, which were Henry A. v. Wilton, Armijo, which is from the 10th Circuit, and Kennedy v. Ridgefield. I think they stand for the proposition that when you look at what an action is, it can take various forms. And for example, in Kennedy, it involved the police advising a person that they were going to inform her when the accuser was confronted. Failure to do so led to the killer killing the neighbor. So you have situations in which the action itself is looked at differently than saying just a clear affirmative act. It involves, I think, grades. When you look at these cases, here you have minimal, basically, the bully getting a slap in the hand at counseling session, not informing the parents. So then what you have is Haley knowing that if she reports bullying, nothing will be done. And she goes back into that school system, gets bullied more, commits suicide, and then tells the world.
But in Kennedy, there was also a promise made, was there not, that we'll give you extra police patrols in your neighborhood, and that didn't happen either. But in Kennedy, wasn't the danger exacerbated by the officer who had promised to notify the victim family if he contacted the subject, and then he did in fact contact the subject, which apparently sent the subject into a rage, and he never told the family that he'd done that. That's affirmative conduct, is it not? That increases the danger to, in that case, the victim.
So what would be analogous here is they took the position, they took an act, and here it wasn't talking to the accused. It was talking to the same thing. It was talking to the accused, but then doing nothing about it, really, other than a counselor and sending her back, and then failing to inform the parents. So if you talk about Kennedy where you have, we're going to warn you, and then you don't warn, that's exactly the situation here, which exacerbates the situation, because you have a child understanding that the policies of school are not going to be followed, and that they're not going to be protecting her because they took an action that demonstrated that to her and caused her to then be distressed.
You wanted to say it for a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Dan Pulsberg for the Clark County School District Defendants. This certainly is a tragic case, and our hearts go out to the Lamberts, but all of these cases are tragic. This Court pointed that out in Patel. Justice Rehnquist pointed that out in Cheney, but just because there is a terrible situation doesn't mean that there is a constitutional remedy as opposed to a state law remedy. And let's look at, we're drilling down on the exception.
What is the status of the Clark County District Court?
The trial was just continued. The trial is going to take place in August.
Okay, so the case is proceeding forward.
It is. Very much so. We're drilling down on the exception, but let's remember the general rule to which we had this exception. That is that a substantive due process claim can be brought against the government for the government's actions. Now, there are a few exceptions to that, and we're dealing with the exception where the state actually creates the danger.
Well, that's not what our case is about. The state doesn't have to itself create the danger. It has to convene an existing danger that the state does something.
I see. Judge Watford, I agree.
That makes the situation worse, right?
Yes.
So here, I thought the plaintiff's best theory was this, that beyond just failing to intervene when really the state should have to do something about this or to at least know that the parents, the reason the state made it affirmatively worse is because I think there was a meeting between Haley and one of the school deans in which the dean made Haley aware that, yes, the school knew about this harassment that was going on. And then, in combination with the training she had received, which suggested that if the harassment were serious, the school would do something. When the school did something, that's when Haley said, well, I guess there's no way out.
Well, and that's a new theory. That wasn't argued in the district court, and I'm not sure it was in the opening brief. It seems to be more, and that was Judge Tallman's question to plaintiffs, is the argument that the school district caused her despondency. And I don't think that's what this case has been about. And and factually what they've alleged. Now, I'm trying to carve out what we know from discovery and what's in the complaint. They allege that there was a report of bullying, that one dean met with Haley and one dean met with JJ, that they talked to them, and it's clear from both the exhibits to the opposition to the motion summary judgment and the opposition to the motion amend that there was no problem between those students ever again after that. And the school district was not aware of any other bullying having to do with Haley until after her death.
The online report that was submitted, which went to the dean, involved not JJ, but the other student.
No, that was JJ. CG did an online report involving Haley's encounter, and she put it in the plural, but there's nothing to say that there actually was, besides that and subsequent reports, that there was more than one encounter in PE class.
I'm not sure it makes a difference which student it was. Haley felt victimized by both of the students who were harassing her.
But the school district did not know about CH at all.
Well, okay, it doesn't matter.
But that doesn't matter. Just offer to explain why I think it matters. Because if their theory is that we created some kind of environment where Haley had an expectation that something more would be done, we would have to know that there was something in the first place.
Right. So, I'm not disputing that one of the students did learn about at least one of the students harassing her, right?
There's no dispute that we all knew about her encounter with JJ. One dean met with Haley, one dean met with JJ, investigated, no dispute whether that's an investigation, but they were both interviewed about what happened, and nothing ever happened between those two students after that. So there was action taken. I would contend, based on the record that we have in front of this court, that there was adequate action taken. But I also disagree with, and I realize that you're saying that that's their best argument, but I don't think that action and the failure to go forward constitutes something that would fall under the state-created danger exception. And that's what we call it, and I understand it doesn't have to depend on us creating the danger, but we do have to at least do three things under the state-created danger exception. We have to take affirmative action. That action has to result in harm that is greater than the status quo, and we have to do that with deliberate indifference. So a lot of the opinions put those as two factors. I think the dissent from the rehearing and bank and Kennedy puts it as three factors. And certainly it's important that we look at the second one either as part of the first factor or by itself, because I don't think we meet any of those factors here. The failure to go further, the failure to intervene further, the failure to even to keep promises is not enough to be either affirmative action or affirmative action that causes greater danger.
Let me ask you this, and you'll dispute that these are the facts in this case, but let's say that the meeting with the dean resulted in communication agents that said, listen, we're aware of all the harassment by all the students that you're enduring. We will take care of it. You can have your back. This is going to be, this is not tolerable. We're going to fix this. And so they're after some weeks of harassment, it's obviously. I guess nothing is going to be done. This is hopeless. And took our life as a result. In that scenario, are the three boxes you laid out?
And for two different reasons. First of all, just making a promise is not enough. This court in Patel distinguished Kennedy by saying, okay, promises being made, although there were promises being made in Kennedy, and we found a state-created danger, that wasn't the extent of the situation. In Patel, there were promises that wasn't enough to create a prima facie case of state-created danger. And in Kennedy, there was so much more than the promise. It wasn't just that the police promised to send patrol cars that night. It was that they had said to the family, we're not going to tell your neighbor that you reported the 13-year-old molester. And then they did tell.
But they just said, we'll let you know before we do this.
And that was the second thing. They said, we'll let you know. And they didn't let them know. Right. So they created the danger. danger, and the police officers created the danger to the neighbors.
If I'm saying with a 13-year-old, we all know how vulnerable 13-year-olds are to the kind of harassment that Haley was enduring, that it might be the case that the state makes things worse, right? The existing harassment is bad enough, and the state didn't create that. But you might well make that situation worse from the student's standpoint if the school says, we're aware of this, and basically communicates the interaction, unless we're not going to do anything about it. And that could add an additional layer of despondency and hopelessness that might move a 13-year-old from just being very unhappy to actually taking their lives.
Well, could. And they quoted one of my deans who said that this could have resulted in the suicide. And all she said when she said that was, well, could have. I don't think could have is enough. And that's why earlier when I was talking about your hypothetical, I said two reasons. The second reason is that the causation here, the foreseeability here of the suicide is so much more remote. Yes, we're dealing with 13-year-olds, and Your Honor, my clients deal with 13-year-olds every day. And you cannot say that this would be a foreseeable risk enough to be a known or obvious danger, either for the third prong, or enough to say that they were sending Haley into a dangerous situation just by letting her leave the dean's office. They keep saying, we sent her back into the classroom, but there's no proof that the classroom was the place of the harm. It's not like the Kennedy case where the government or actors there actually caused the situation to be worse.
The student JJ was in the classroom, if I remember.
Well, the other CE class, but that was never a problem again. I know that to be the case.
I'm not sure you really know that. Yes. Can I ask you about the Title IX claim?
Sure.
I know it was added late, but
quite late.
Yes. Okay. Well, maybe you can address why is it one that came forward to make it a viable Title IX claim?
Well, what Judge Gordon did in dealing with the motion to amend, remember the plaintiffs were going only on a substantive due process claim, and after that was dismissed, 106 days after the deadline to move to amend, they added a Title IX claim, an ADA claim, an IDEA claim, a procedural due process claim, some equal protection claims, and there's another one I'm forgetting. And Judge Gordon said, well, no, that's, remember, there are four reasons you can deny a motion to amend. It's in bad faith, it's dilatory, it's futile, and it causes prejudice. And the judge found, A, that the amendments were futile, the same, their substantive due process claim.
I ask you about the Title IX.
Yes. And B, that they were too late. It caused prejudice to us. Fact discovery was closed.
They say that they did not learn the facts that support the Title IX claim until after, the original complaint had been filed, the motion to dismiss the chief
understanding. Judge Gordon flatly rejected that. He said there's no newly discovered evidence. They don't come forward with what evidence is the basis of all their new claims, and they don't come forward with the reason why it's newly discovered. And he specifically found it would prejudice us to have to do discovery on those claims.
Did he also find intentional delay on the part of the plaintiffs that they knew before the deadline?
He said it was all the new claims. He said it was a tactical, I think you may have said strategic decision to bring in these claims after the other claims had been dismissed, because they had said in their reply brief, the motion to amend, that there was no reason to bring all these claims earlier. And so he took that as an admission that it was a purposeful and strategic decision. If the court has no other questions,
Judge Cole, do you have any questions?
No questions here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. So I think you have 2 minutes and 43 seconds.
30 seconds, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly on the motion to amend the complaint, one point that is not raised by counsel is the fact that in opposing the motion to dismiss, in that motion, in our opposition, we asked for leave to amend. That was before any cutoff was in place. That was before any date had passed. We asked the court, if you're inclined to dismiss our case, we want to be able to amend. The other notion is that after we have fully briefed the papers and we believe that our pleading is sufficient to somehow require us, after having asked for leave to amend, to come back and say to the court, please let us file another amended complaint.
As I understood what Judge Gordon was concerned about, the case management schedule, which included deadlines for filing summary judgment motions, and you're almost saying, I wanted to see how he ruled on the summary judgment motion before I decide whether or not I'm going to amend my complaint.
No, it's a summary judgment motion, Your Honor. He set a deadline for him. There was summary judgment deadlines, but that wasn't one.
Cut off of discovery, yeah. And then he made specific findings that after that schedule was put in place, that you were not able to give sufficient cause for why you waited as long as you did to request the amendment. So, no cause, and that you intentionally delayed. So, what do we do with that factual finding?
Because he waited 6 months to rule, so we deferred to the court because they were considering our opposition.
You knew you had the claim. Why didn't you simply file a motion to amend?
Well, we thought we had, because the attack was on the state-created danger, we believe we had properly pled it. But nonetheless, even if that was the standard, under Rule 16, we took 15 depositions, we put additional evidence in, and we clearly had good cause. And what the judge did is treated as a motion for summary judgment, wanting us to present all that evidence at a pleading stage. And I know I'm going to run out of time, but I will say that counsel was incorrect to state that the argument that Casey Haley had been despondent because of the conduct is actually in our proposed amended complaint, and it's also in our opening brief.
Wait, proposed amended?
The proposed amended complaint from which we appealed the denial of, and also in our opening brief at page 7.
How is that before Judge Gordon if you didn't make the amendment and provide him with a copy?
We made a motion, we provided a copy of the complaint, we put it in there, he denied that, we appealed. To say it's a new theory is incorrect. It's at page 7 to 8, 21 to 23, 32 to 33 of our opening papers here.
I didn't just make a theory, you guys put it in there. But can I ask you just one question if you're over your time? But I'm just totally out of curiosity, I think otherwise I should appeal, but why are you not content with seemingly very strong state law claims that you can pursue under state tort laws? Is there some kind of immunity that is available?
If there are caps that are put under Nevada law that are not in 1983 cases, and they complete to change just the dynamics of the case.
You assume no entitlement to attorney's fees, as there is.
I believe that would be the case.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Case just argued is submitted. We can answer as soon as we can. The next case for argument is United States versus the County of Maricopa, number 15-17598.